is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I'm John Batchelor, speaking with Adrian Wooldridge, who is Badgett for The Economist magazine, but as author, the new book, The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian's book presents the case for who is best, who is wisest, who is most prosperous, who is a leader. For 2,500 years, from Plato all the way to the 20th century, the 21st century. And yet, in the 21st century, starting in the middle of the 20th, there are doubts about meritocracy, about how it's rendered. And that comes to the invention of the word meritocrat or meritocracy. A man by the name of Young writes a book in the middle of the 19th century that raises these questions, these doubts. And we need to begin there because, as Adrian explicates, this is a criticism that enjoys, in America, we would say bipartisanship. The right at the left, the center, everybody has doubts. And so we go to Michael Young, 1958, Meritocracy. Adrian, what are Michael Young's doubts in the middle of the 20th century? And then we'll examine the rest of the 20th century.
Yeah, in 1958, Michael Young, who is a Labour Party peer, eventually, a Labour Party activist, and who is one of the authors of the extraordinary 1945 Labour Manifesto, which helps them to win the landslide victory in 1945. Michael Young writes a book called The Rise of the Meritocracy. And this book basically is a denunciation of the meritocracy. People thought at that time that the left was on the side of meritocracy and that merit was something that the left embraced. In fact, Michael Young says no. And his argument is that meritocracy smuggles in the spirit of competition, smuggles that spirit into the heart of society because it replaces equality of outcome with equality of opportunity. And what it does is to create an intolerable system whereby the successful think that the only reason that they're successful is because they're clever and therefore that they owe their positions entirely to their own merits, and that the stupid or the less successful or the people who are left at the bottom of society have no one to blame for them but themselves and their lack of ability for being at the bottoms of society. And so what he's saying is paradoxically saying, well, aristocracy and the old world of priority, degree, and place may have been awful, but at least the people at the bottom could blame the fact that they were at the bottom on the fact that society was unjust. And the people at the top, the aristocrats, might have a sense, well, they didn't really deserve their position. So they might have a sense of noblesse oblige towards the people at the bottom. So Michael Young is saying the problem with meritocracy is that it works. And it creates, because it works, an intolerable society.
Yes, it's not, IQ tests aren't inaccurate, they're too accurate, it says my note here, and they create division and alienation. Good heavens, we see enough of that. Now let's begin, before Michael Young's book, the predicate for this is already in your reporting. In the 1930s, there is a movement to dismantle 11 plus, already to take it apart, because it was seen as too close to a race science. Also, a man with a wonderful name. Sometimes I think Dickens didn't invent very much because this is a real name. Lancelot Hogban. He believes that IQ is nurture, not nature. And therefore, using an IQ test only gives you something that you'd already known, that those who have the prosperity to be well-educated are going to rise to the top.
Exactly. I mean, one of the most powerful criticisms on the left of meritocracy is it's essentially propaganda for plutocrats, that it just justifies existing inequalities. And the fact that people do well in IQ tests doesn't prove anything about their nature. It doesn't prove that they're by they have greater natural abilities. It just proves that they happen to be born to privileged backgrounds and they've been well-educated, they've been well-fed, and well-nurtured, and Lancelot Hogban is one of the leading and most interesting advocates of that position. So there is a very profound criticism coming from the left that IQ tests don't measure anything but privilege. And if they just measure privilege, then they're basically fallacious, that they're basically a lie.
You're right that meritocracy suddenly is a false god. And everyone who had been following this for a couple of 100 years, thinking that this could explain the success of the United Kingdom starting in the 19th century, became a world power. The Royal Navy, all of this. It is strange that this argument starts so early. I go now to a political response to meritocracy by the Communist Party, which is vibrant at this time because these are the 1930s and the 1940s, and the Soviets were allies with the United Kingdom until they weren't. What do the communists say?
Well, the Communist Party is quite interesting on the subject of meritocracy because initially the Communist Party is very much in favor of meritocracy, and they're initially very much in favor of psychometric tests, IQ tests, and they're even in favor of undoubtedly a foolish science, which is the science of phrenology. So they collect a lot of heads, a lot of skulls, and they collect they put Lenin's skull on display after his death and say, this is a skull of a man with a really big brain. So the communists buy the whole, not just meritocracy, but a lot of pseudoscience like phrenology. And then by the middle of the 1920s, they rapidly change their position. And they say meritocracy is just a capitalist plot, that IQ testing is just part of this capitalist plot, that nature matters much, much more than nurture. And they become the leading critics from a highly egalitarian point of view of IQ testing, educational selection, the 11 plus, and all of that, and become doughty warriors for equality of outcome.
The late 20th century sees again and again books that are criticizing the idea that brain power is a quality that we should venerate or trust or follow. We come now to two books that Adrian highlights. I don't know. I know one of them, David Halberstam's Best and Brightest, about the Vietnam War not being the product of a Republican populace, but being the best that Harvard intellectuals could do. The second book is more profound, John Rawls' Theory of Justice. But let's begin with David Halberstam. Did it rock the leadership in Europe that Halberstam mocked the decisions of the Vietnam War?
Well, Europe was very ambivalent about the Vietnam War, and many, many people thought that the Vietnam War was just an ill-conceived project. But what was unique about Halberstam's view was that he said that these were the best and brightest. These were the clever people. If you give power to the clever people, the assumption has always been that you get enlightenment and reason and sensible policy. And he says, actually, what you got, because of their very sophisticated theories about dominoes falling and because of the very strategic advice that they were giving first to Kennedy and then to to LBJ, that you got really, really bad decisions. So that actually the military, which had been much more cautious about Vietnam, were sensible. They might be, they might be graduates of football colleges rather than graduates of Harvard, but they had much more common sense. And this was a beginning of a very profound critique of meritocracy, which can be summed up in the old statement that you'd rather trust the first 500 names in the Boston telephone directory than you would trust the entire Harvard faculty. That ordinary people have common sense, and that intellectuals tend to become obsessed by theories, and that those theories can quite often prove to be wrong, as was the case in the Vietnam War, and arguably was also the case in the Iraq War.
More biting is John Rawls' Theory of Justice, 1971, where Mr. Rawls makes the case that it's not hard work, it's not nature, it's not nurture, it's that what we have here is an offense to reason because we need distributive justice. We don't need leadership. What is distributive justice?
Well, what Rawls says is that the notion of merit depends on the notion of desert, that people who work harder and people who are cleverer deserve to get more rewards. And Rawls says that this isn't the case. And it's not the case because the propensity to be clever or the propensity to work hard are things that are inherited. They're actually the result of nature. Rawls is actually very, very much a man who believes in nature rather than nurture. But he says, because you inherit your genetically your intelligence, and because you inherit your capacity for hard work, then you don't deserve to be given rewards in excess of other people, except if by giving those rewards, the overall quality of life in the whole of society is improved. So he does accept a certain amount of differentiation, but only if that differentiation could be justified by lifting up the whole boat. And that's a very profound critique, not only of the meritocratic principle, but of the broader sort of American notion that you should have open competition in which the people who get the most rewards keep those rewards as much as possible because they deserve them, because they're the product of their own initiative and intelligence and work and effort. And it's an argument which has had, of course, massive influence over the academy and over the legal system.
The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian Wooldridge is the author. When we come back, the new nepotism, the new rich, and meritocracy. I'm John Batchelor.